Welcome back to Insights Unlocked. I'm Nathan Isaacs and thankful that you're joining us today. In this episode, User Testing's Lawrence Williams talks with Don Procopio, founder and principal UX researcher at AIethicist.com. They explore the critical role of UX researchers in ensuring that AI and machine learning models are human-centered, ethically sound, and actually solve the problem for which they are designed. Enjoy the show.
Welcome to Insights Unlocked, an original podcast from User Testing, where we bring you candid conversations and stories with the thinkers, doers, and builders behind some of the most successful digital products and experiences in the world, from concept to execution.
Welcome to the Insights Unlocked podcast. I'm Nathan Isaacs, Senior Manager for Content Production at User Testing. And joining us today as host is User Testing's Lawrence Williams, a solution consultant, sociologist, and author. Welcome, Lawrence.
Hi, Nathan.
And our guest today is Don Procopio. Don is the founder and principal UX researcher at her consultancy, AI Ethicist. She is a veteran researcher and has worked with Siemens, Meta, Amazon Web Services, among other companies. Today's discussion is on the question of how is UX research for machine learning different from UX research for design? Welcome to the show, Don.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So Don, welcome to the show. I'm really interested in the name of your business, AI Ethicist. Can you tell me more about yourself and AI Ethicist and how that name, AI Ethicist, connects back to your research work?
Yeah, so I guess I should start pretty much with my formal training. I'm a political science graduate by trade, but I had taken a lot of bioethicist classes. So a lot of legal philosophy courses, just on and on about how terrible dilemmas can occur in medical settings. So I guess that kind of framed my worldview as I went into UX research. I started out in a number of healthcare settings, got the chance to work on a lot of pharmaceutical digital experiences, stuff where you like take a pill and then there's a sensor in it and it talks to your app. So a lot of people don't know that that kind of usability study is legally required. And so you have to go to the FDA and get UX research on that. And so that kind of awakened my, you know, my ethicist roots in political science. I thought I was going to be a bioethicist, and now I'm just working towards that. I really think all UX researchers are kind of like guardians of the user galaxy in that sense, making sure that we are helping machines be human because we give them the human data. There are no other product development trades that offer up the human data directly. So you can scrape all this data online, but in terms of directly facilitating how humans become themselves and all of the nuanced variables, you only get that from UX research. That's kind of why I registered AIethicist.com. Actually, the registration's including .com for a philosophical reason. I think the commercial intent behind a lot of ethical dilemmas is much more scary than some of the more benign dilemmas from the non-commercial world. So it's actually AIethicist.com.
Oh, wow. Well, thanks for the context, your background in political science and your focus on dilemmas. My dissertation and my book are actually called Thinking Through Dilemmas. And so one of my case studies was death and dying, so medical. So I think there's a lot of synergies there. But I guess, you know, just based on, you know, you're touching on how UX research is so central to the development and shaping of AI and machine learning. But, you know, one thing I've noticed, I've been in this space for a couple of years, is there's tons of examples of like AI and machine learning informing research and design. Like you know, the way UX researchers process data, how they use ChatGPT and things like that. What are your thoughts, like in particular, in how UX research informs how those models are created and deployed to the public?
Yeah, there are two major ways UX researchers can actually help AI scientists, predominantly machine learning scientists, machine learning professionals, engineers. The first, and I think the most important, is ensuring ecological validity, making sure that the conclusions we draw from the model actually are pertaining to the target domain and the problem, and they're not just, you know, really fanciful displays of human intellect with regard to the performance of the model. But the other outcome is that UX researchers actually can help the performance of the model be even better. And to me, these are almost the same issue because they do converge at some point. But there are five main ways that I think UX researchers need to collaborate with machine learning professionals. And I have this like acronym that I use to remember it. It's called PRIDE, P-R-I-D-E. And it's basically, it's problem, representation, interpretability, data leakage, and evaluation metrics. Those five touch points in a conversation or over many conversations between a UX researcher and a machine learning professional can increase the ecological validity of the model and increase the performance of the model. Yeah, I just think that not a lot of researchers actually think that they can help these really, really talented engineers do their job better, but also that it's really almost unethical if they don't. And so there's always, you know, findings about design. I think a lot of researchers find it really easy to find design errors or areas to improve. And also it's really easy to make recommendations about the risks of conversion metrics, you know, not achieving adoption, retention, task success, but actually having the risk that we develop a lot of machines that have nothing to do with the human experience is probably the worst outcome. With the problem type, you know, it sounds like, yeah, UX researchers are always looking to make sure that the problem is centered on the user. And this is a little bit different. When a machine learning scientist talks about a problem type, they're actually talking about the solution. For the researcher, they should flip it around. When the machine learning professional says, I have a problem type, they're probably talking about one of three things: classification, regression, or clustering problems. And that's how the data should appear to the human, not necessarily how the human thinks about the problem. So that's why I say it's more about the solution. With classification, you know, that's from a UX research or data science perspective, that's a categorical variable. When they say regression, they mean continuous. They don't mean that, but we should translate that as continuous. And when they say clustering, that's pretty much the same for a UX researcher. But what UX researchers might not know is that not knowing what solution type is ideal for the user can basically have the machine learning professional make an entire model out of, you know, something that's not geared towards one of those outcomes. So knowing the problem type literally informs the model selection, because only certain models will produce one of those three types. You know, if, for instance, you're making a movie recommendation algorithm and the machine learning professionals think that they really want to see, you know, movies that are related to another movie and that they should be basically based on clusters, versus there could be some UX research evidence that shows that the users actually want to see the highest ranked or a continuous measurement based on previous interactions like a thumbs up or a star rating, which would change the entire model and become very expensive if in the end users weren't interested in seeing the next movie, the next recommendation based on preset clusters. Maybe they wanted to see like things that were related to their rankings, their manual rankings. That would be very expensive to change midway.
And that's a fascinating example. I don't know if this was machine learning. I'm assuming it was, but I ran a study recently on a product display page, and it was on the like similar items or customers purchased something like this. And there was so much feedback around exactly, they weren't using those words, but they were like, these weren't the items I was expecting to see, or I would want to see all of a similar brand, or people were kind of all over the map. And it made me think, as what you're saying, like, wow, I really don't know. Is it by price point? Is it by brand? Is it by product category? So I guess, you know, what I'm hearing from you is, if we get ahead of this from a UX research standpoint and see how what is the human and like, what are they looking for before we invest in the model? Okay, we just want it through, you know, clustering or regression. Is that kind of, am I hearing
yeah.
it right?
Yeah, exactly. So I ran a study that involved IDIs and participatory design for a conversation between an imaginary movie recommender agency and a customer. So I actually, and I flipped them the dynamic where I was actually the customer and I asked the participant to be the human movie recommender. So they, I said, imagine, you know, you're at your desk, it's a nice morning at your boutique movie recommendation agency, and I walk in and I want a movie recommendation. And so the actual model was ended up being based on the types of questions that the participant asked me. And so that literally was a one-to-one mirror with what's called a decision tree classifier, where the machine asks questions of the data and starts splitting off the movies into different groups based on each question. And so it's very similar to that game where, you know, say I tell you I'm thinking of an animal, and then all you can do to guess the animal is ask questions like, does it fly, does it have fur? So this is the kind of experience in the session, and those kinds of questions literally get modeled into the decision classifier. So seeing that and seeing how different personas come up with different ways of splitting up movies really helped them build the model from the get-go, not just tweak it later on. And that's very different than design, because here it's more like service design, not necessarily UI design. So you have to think about, how does the participant want the solution to be offered content-wise? But anyway,
that's fascinating. Like, one of the thing that stood out most to me when I entered UX was information architecture, because as a social psychologist, I studied cognitive architecture, and I'm like, is that, you know, I just found it such an interesting term. And I think what you're saying, what I'm being so fascinated by is this idea of the machine model picking up on this conversation and saying, okay, is this the person's, like, you know, in UX, we talk about mental models all the time. And it's like, is this actually architecting the right mental model? And then to your point, for whom and to what extent? And will this clash with other models that we have and other data points? Like, for me, I talk about dilemma. It feels like it could kind of keep going and going and going. But I think that's where the UX research work becomes so key. It's that constant human check.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, what's more than that is, and I'll get to, I don't know how to segue this, but these other conversational touch points. So representation, interpretability, and data leakage evaluation metrics. So with representation, what the machine learning professional actually means by representation is very different than what we do. They might use this. It's actually a formal phase in the machine learning process. But what they're going to get into is something called feature selection and feature modeling and feature engineering. And so what the UX researcher should hear is variable creation and what variables matter and what inputs matter. And so I think this is really interesting because, you know, UX researchers have so many variables, and oftentimes we have these really small sample sizes. And what a machine learning scientist will see is something called high dimensionality, where there's more variables than there are people in a study, or where the sample size is smaller than the amount of feature. And so, I mean, UX researchers should really be excited about this, because they have specific models to deal with high dimensionality versus low dimensionality. And it telling the machine learning scientists whether a problem is high dimensional or low dimensional, whether, you know, there could be a lot of UX research about whether or not, you know, you have these really small sample sizes, but you're finding that the same amount of high variability is happening within each session. That's one thing. But also, what features matter? You know, UX researchers often have these libraries where they can tag things. I love user testing for this, where they can make highlight reels, and those highlight reels have the hashtags that sync between the highlight reels, and then you can just look up a hashtag and see all the videos for that. Over time, UX researchers can offer this data and say, look, this hashtag/variable is a huge feature that I think has to be in your model, or you need to engineer this variable. And the way they'll do that is they'll take a lot of variables and mathematically make that variable for you with a larger sample size, maybe in an online A/B test. That's something that I really enjoyed at Meta when The UX researchers were at the table with the data scientists. Literally every experiment there happens with UX researchers, at least the ones I was on. So when you go online at Meta, it's like they're not just experimenting, you know, in the blind from the engineer's perspective. The UX researchers are involved at the table and saying, you know, that feature, that variable has research, or we don't know about that, and that's something we'd have to research further. There is a two-way street, but
you're getting all my juices buzzing, because one thing, you know, I'm always encouraging UX researchers to think in terms of multivariables in a single test. Like, you think this test ostensibly is, oh, a checkout flow, we're measuring time on task or something like that, but then there's so much more, and that's the richness that comes out of qualitative data. But then the challenge is, you know, you're not able to, like, cognitively, we can only process like 7 things at once or whatever. You can't see all of that. And so I think there's this huge opportunity that, again, it's like, you know, you think of the richness of an ethnographic interview, and then machine learning actually being able to do all these other sorts of classifications to say, hey, this experience, even if you just, you know, bracket all of that, this is actually a high dimensional activity. There's a lot of valence going on. Qualitatively, you see that, like, there's a lot of emotion, there's a lot of, you know, discord, dissonance, and then it's just fascinating to see what the machine learning picks up of these, again, perhaps some areas of the UI, you know, gelling and others being discordant, and then how does that tie into the model? But anyway, you're just provoking a lot of thought.
So. No, thank you. I mean, yeah, I, you know, we need to collaborate on this stuff, because there are some sticky dilemmas that you get into with representation. For instance, with this movie recommender system I was working on, you know, there was a age factor in, you know, whether a movie is recommended to you or not. Like, if the system thinks you're a 5-year-old, then you might get Disney movies. But if the system doesn't think you're a 5-year-old, you might not see those. And so having certain variables in the model get really sticky, and that's where UX researchers really need to be at the table and say, no, my persona is really sensitive about this issue. You know, for my scenario where, you know, it was a movie recommendation system, it wasn't an issue to use age as a variable for whether or not the recommendation was made. But there are certain areas where age can be really sticky, and that's especially when age is not directly asked in, like, a registration process where it's inferred or engineered from other features. So for instance, let's say, this is a really morbid thought, but let's say a recommendation system uses your avatar to infer your age. How much of your personas, or which personas would be comfortable with that? When is that beneficial? And those sometimes, that question sometimes needs a study. You need to do a specific study on that if you're not absolutely confident. And I would say you can't be confident without UX research on that. And sometimes it's a really good idea, depending on the service, you know, if it could help somebody. So for instance, let's say Google decides to use your avatar to surface up advertisements, like you're in your advanced age and you actually are somebody who's looking out for different kinds of medications. Is it ethical to use that person's, you know, age inference from their avatar to make decisions about the advertisements that they should see? You know, that's something we'd have to do a study on, how they feel about that. It's not necessarily a privacy issue, because it's not about what they gave the system. A lot of people don't register for Google, or they don't have they don't require your age when you upload a picture to your avatar. So these are really interesting questions with respect to representation, what the variables actually represent.
Well, and I think you're tapping into something really key. I mean, it just makes me think of, like, the idea of stereotype threat. And if you think now that AI is picking up on, it's inferring, you know, from my age, my gender, my, and then is it clustering those things together? So then it's, you know, as a man of a certain race, of a certain age, am I then going to get targeted for this and that? And so I could see how that could be very helpful for certain things, but that's where research has to come in, because it could just be reinforcing stereotypes of people and things they're potentially wanting to avoid.
And that's really the company, the .com's get out of jail card. I mean, when they go to Congress and they're accused of something, all they have to do is show the research. I mean, when these companies go to Congress, I'm just like, show me the research. Like Jerry Maguire, I'm just like, literally all you have to do is say, we did a usability test and we had these videos that show that people were fine with them. And we had it in a sufficient amount of sample size. We also modeled this on a survey and used, you know, machine learning to see this at a bigger scale. So yeah, like, I mean, I just don't understand why you have to make these decisions in the dark with philosophy or theory alone.
Yeah, they should be empirically driven. From my perspective, it makes, I mean, AI is here for better or for worse, and machine learning, and it's, I mean, you know, it's almost like the new industrial revolution, right? Like, it's the way that it's shaping things, and the opportunity we have is exactly like the work that you're doing, right? Of saying, okay, let's be at the helm, let's be the composer, as opposed to letting it run ramshot over us, right? And we're like just being a Luddite, running away from it.
It's crazy. I mean, and then so. That gets at the ecological validity of it. But what about the performance for representation? Well, actually, if the UX researcher doesn't give the ML machine, the ML professional knowledge about the correlations between variables or the feature dependence, then they will also select the wrong model. So there are models that are specifically geared for feature independence versus feature dependence. And so if you don't sit at that table and say, you know, these two things about users, we see, but they're very highly correlated, or that, you know, even in my qualitative studies, it always comes up. If you don't offer that information, again, the model selection will be just completely wrong. And the assumptions will just be invalid. That gets at the performance of it. It won't, in production, when they release it, it just won't perform like it does with the training data. With interpretability, the trade-off for a machine learning scientist is interpretability versus model complexity. And so they can make a really accurate model that's super great and magical, but then it becomes completely uninterpretable. And that's really sensitive for some personas. And in some cases, that can cause user errors when a user can't understand what's being fed back to them. Imagine you meeting somebody at a party and they know all these things about you and you have no idea why or how they're doing it, or they're making all these recommendations for you and you just don't understand why they're making that recommendation. And they could say, you know, like, I recommend you have this wine over this other wine, but you're like, why? And they can't tell you why. That would be a very awkward experience, and that's very uncomfortable, not having that autonomy to say, you know, I understand your rationale, thank you for that information. That's something that is really relished in human experience, and I don't think we want to start giving that up, where we just start blindly following whatever chatbots tell us. We need to have some rationale. And when you ask ChatGPT to cite their sources, they should be able to cite their sources. They should be able to give you clickable sources if in fact it was gathered from somewhere on the internet.
Well, and I think as per your point, right, getting the holistic, like what humans want, I mean, the current trend or whatever for at least the last 10 years is personalization. And people want to feel, you know, in general, like even from actual humans, from cashiers, from retail stores, they want to, you know, Starbucks, when it was so innovative at the, you know, it did so well by having that advanced customer experience, and we're bringing that digital. So I think for something like a chatbot, yeah, if you were to, I haven't actually tried that now, I want to see if it can support its claim to me.
Yeah, I mean, it's unbelievable that we have such a low bar for the machine learning process to back up what they think is an excellent performance. The real issue, in addition to this, is that, you know, if you wanted to test this, or if you wanted to understand whether or not an AI was really complex or not complex, you have to look at an agreed upon framework. And one of the biggest frameworks for this is the levels of AI definitions from Google DeepMind's paper. And they have like six levels. Level three is like 90% of people can't do something. Level four is 99% of people can't do something. And so the default response to a machine learning professional should be, you know, are we talking about, when you talk about complexity, sir or ma'am, what do you mean? Are we talking level 4 or level 3? And then how do we know that? I mean, for a machine learning professional, say, well, we estimate that 90% of people can't do this, and so this is a level 3 expert AI. And that means that you have to ask, you know, how do you know 90% of people can't do that? And so that's a good opportunity for you to say, wait a minute, before we talk about interpretability and what level of, how explicit do we have to be about the rationale, we need to benchmark it against the model complexity, which can be conversationally talked about as the level of AI. So 90% of people can do it. Okay, let's see if 90% of our users can't do this function. And then we can say, okay, this is a expert level. As a company, this is an expert level AI. So how do we approach all of our expert level AIs with respect to rational surfacing? Where do we surface it? How detailed does it have to be? And then for our level 4 AIs, where 99% of people can't do something, you know, this is called the virtuoso AI. You know, we have to make that explicitness a little bit more. That's how you reference it. That's how you would benchmark, you know, the explicitness. And then you can say, you know, to any litigious person or committee and say, you know, we had an explicit framework when it became level 4 AI. This was our company-wide policy. We tested it. We tested the explicitness of the rationale at this level. And then we tested the explicitness of the rationale at this level. And we knew that that was at this level because we did these other studies that showed that 90% of users could not do this, or 99% of users could not do this. So this is how a UX researcher can really inform how we surface the rationality, or how explicit the rationality has to be, but also how the company would defend their decision and their investigation of it. Having a straightforward way of doing it. Otherwise, you know, you're just sitting around a table and being like, well, this is a really complex model. And the UX researcher has to just sit and say, okay, by whose standard is it complex? They don't have to use Google DeepMind's framework, but doing something like that would structure the study.
I love that, because I mean, it's really what you're doing there is like you're applying kind of design thinking to something that's so complex seemingly, and saying, well, let's unpack this and let's say, what is, you know, if this is something that's going to scale beyond the reach of humans, right, and be fully automated, which is the goal, let's de-risk that and at different stages, and in the process you're defending all of your assumptions. It's ambitious, but it definitely sounds like something that, you know, you found success with, and you know, definitely I think our listeners will be inspired by that. I know we have two more in the pride, so data leakage and evaluation measures, if you wanted to touch on those, because I'm equally fascinated by the PR on AI so far.
we're pressed for time. So data leakage is really simple. Now that we talked about like what variables are features, data leakage is not privacy. I know that sounds like privacy when people hear about it colloquially, but actually, it's about when there are variables that shouldn't be in the training data. They're actually more about future information, and they can sneak into the training data unbeknownst to the ML engineer because they don't know very much about the features. So if the ML professional doesn't know what each feature actually represents, or what features actually mean, and how are they made, and how are they interacted with in the wild, then they can accidentally include a variable that they shouldn't because it contains future information about the actual dependent variable. And so an example of this is, for instance, you have patient IDs, and the ML engineer just uses the patient IDs anyway because, I don't know, they don't feel like cleaning the data, they don't feel like siphoning it off from the data set. And they're like, oh, it's harmless, patient IDs are fine, and we're predicting cancer, for instance. Well, the patient ID, if you're a UX researcher, you need to know how that patient ID got created. If that patient ID got created by seeing a specialist and that patient ID looks different, now that patient ID includes information about the future where they saw a specialist, like an oncologist. And so now the training data is looking overly optimistic, or the training period is looking overly optimistic because it has this silent information or this latent variable built within the patient ID. And that, and avoiding that is really about knowing how the variables got created in the first place, knowing how every human interacted with that. You know, if you did UX research or ethnography on the setting in which you got that variable, then you could see that person is creating an ID, not just from, you know, a randomizer, but they're selecting, you know, maybe drop downs based on who they saw that day. And that number sequence or alphanumeric sequence contains information about that. So that's one example. And it's really about model performance, and which could eventually affect, you know, people who think that the model is really great. But it's less about ecological validity, but more about performance. If they catch it, if they are releasing a model and they think it's performing and it's not, then yeah, then there is an ecological validity issue. But anyway, evaluation metrics is really important for UX researchers to get into, because what you want to know is whether you need to avoid false positives or avoid false negatives. So for instance, in the cancer situation, if you are detected cancer, having a false positive, being told you have cancer when you don't, is not as bad as not being told that you have cancer when you do. And that's, you want to avoid false negatives in that situation and err on a false positive. But that's different for like crime. So if a UX researcher is testing an interface for police officers to detect crime in an area, you want to avoid false positives and err on a false negative. And you can have a rule of thumb, you know, based on the balance of observations. Do you think most of the time there is no crime and or most of the time there is crime? Then you can do that. But a lot of this is also based on UX research interviews and sensitivities to that persona. So in our world, UX research, we're not doing such dynamically different things where it's very obvious whether you want to avoid false positives or false negatives. But you have this middle ground where you're not sure. And the whether it's false positive or false negative could be irrelevant. And that's called a balanced data problem. And so there are evaluation metrics for that. That's why it's important for you to collaborate. I think of it as P and P, precision for avoiding false positives, and you wanna use recall for avoiding false negatives. Your ML engineer professional should know this because they get trained on this, but they don't know actually inherently whether the users want you to avoid false negatives or false positives, except in those extreme issues in the medical arena and in the crime arena.
Well, and I think this comes back to the example I gave of like the products like this, right? I don't think people would mind the false positive or I thought I had it and I confused myself on it as well. But I don't think they would mind seeing a product they don't like. The risk of that would be low. But if they were shopping for, again, not to be morbid, but if they were shopping for like, you know, something related to a funeral or something, and they saw all these, like, you and you started inferring from that, or do you also need medication and things? I think that could be extremely jarring.
Yeah, exactly. And so there are some personas that, you know, don't mind false negative or false positive. They're not consciously thinking of that, but you have to, in some cases, you have to interview for it because it's very sticky. That's something that if your ML engineer is not asking you about that, you should be suspicious. You should say, wait a minute, how are we handling errors? And it's not just about the user being prompted on how to, you know, get over errors. So a lot of times in design, there's error recovery as a principle. And that's about how do you get the user to overcome an error? But in this case, we need to have a conversation about how does the machine handle errors? And, you know, where should they error?
I think this is kind of tying the you know, the P in pride of like the problem in the model to the problem with the user and the problem that the solution's solving. It seems very iterative to me. The pride acronym, again, I could spend all day just going through the different aspects. That's absolutely fascinating. Well, you know, I know I very much enjoyed this conversation. I'm sure our listeners did as well. How does someone learn more about you and AI ethicist after this podcast?
Yeah, my portfolio/calling card is AIethicist.com, AI-ethicist.com. And I'm also on LinkedIn. That's my only social media. Yeah.
Amazing. Well, expect an invite from me.
Want to keep the conversation going? You can find the show notes at usertesting.com/podcast. If you haven't already, don't forget to follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Overcast, or Google Play so you never miss an episode. And if you enjoyed today's show, please share it with a friend or leave us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. And until next time, this is Insights Unlocked, an original podcast from User Testing.